Imagine spending tens of thousands of dollars on enterprise-grade firewalls, zero-trust networks, and biometric security, only to lose your entire life savings to a teenager with a crowbar. It sounds like a bad movie plot, but for the victims of the social engineering enterprise, it became a living nightmare. And that's the uncomfortable truth behind modern cybercrime. The attack surface doesn't stop at your router. It extends to your driveway, your routine, and the people you love. In this case, the criminals didn't defeat encryption. They defeated fear, time pressure, and the simple fact that most of us aren't prepared for violence as a support ticket.
It really puts a whole new meaning on the phrase vulnerability assessment, doesn't it? Because in this story, the audit isn't a scan or a report, it's a knock at the door. And the finding is brutal. The most secure system in the world still depends on the person who has to live inside it.
It absolutely does, Sue. So let's dig back into this massive federal case out of the Central District of California. Welcome back to Behind the Scams. I'm Nick Henley, and today in part two of our continuing series, we are pivoting instantly from the digital ether we explained in part one into a terrifying physical reality. Today, we're looking at the syndicate's dedicated residential burglary department. Frankly, it's the single most dangerous and unprecedented escalation we have seen from a transnational cyber fraud ring.
And that's the key word, escalation. This syndicate originated on Discord servers and gaming platforms, but they suddenly started kicking in front doors. Why? Because they had to.
Exactly. To understand why this shift happened, we have to look at the one problem they absolutely couldn't solve with a keyboard: perfect digital security. Look, in my 25 years carrying a badge and investigating threat networks, you see a lot of criminal evolution. Cartels start using submersibles when the border tightens. Mobsters move into white-collar shell companies when the RICO statutes get too aggressive. The objective never changes, just the vector. And the vector for this syndicate hit an absolute brick wall when they encountered high net worth targets who were using cold storage physical wallets.
The indictment specifically points out brands like Trezor and Ledger. For our listeners who might not be crypto literate, let's break down why these devices were such a problem for the hackers.
It's the catalyst for the physical violence. A cold storage wallet looks like an ordinary USB thumb drive, but it's not a storage device. It's a vault key. Your crypto doesn't live on the device, it lives on the blockchain. What that little piece of hardware protects are the private keys and the seed phrase, the credentials that prove ownership and authorized transfers, and it keeps them offline, out of reach of remote attackers. In practical terms, it means the syndicate can't fish it, SIM swap it, or brute force it from across the world. When the money is behind an air gap, the only way through is to get within arm's reach of the person holding the keys.
And the industry term for that is air gapping, right?
Right. Think about the vulnerability of your standard online banking or a hot wallet on an exchange. If your private keys are sitting on a server, or even just saved in a password manager on your laptop, a sophisticated hacker in Dubai, Moscow, or Miami can breach that connection. They can execute a remote desktop takeover, bypass your two-factor authentication, and drain your account in milliseconds. But an air-gap device physically severs that connection. It's a physical wall. A hacker cannot breach a piece of plastic and silicon that is sitting in a sock drawer.
And that isolation is enforced by the seed phrase, which isn't a traditional password like your dog's name or a birth year. It's not something you can reset with a help desk ticket. It's the thing that separates "I own this wallet" from "I just have a device that looks expensive."
No, it's a cryptographic master key. Typically a sequence of 12 to 24 random dictionary words generated by the wallet. Words that map to a massive number, and that number becomes the root from which every private key in that wallet can be derived. It's also what lets you restore your funds if the device is destroyed or lost. That's why people write it down on paper, stamp it into metal plates, split it into multiple pieces, and hide it like a will. And here's the part most people miss. The seed phrase doesn't just protect the money, it protects the ability to move the money instantly. If criminals get the seed phrase, they don't need your phone, your SIM, your laptop, or your face. They can rebuild your wallet on their own device from anywhere on Earth and sweep the funds. We are talking about encryption at a level where brute force is fantasy. To put it in human terms, if you took every supercomputer on the planet and tasked them with guessing a 24-word seed phrase, the sun would literally burn out before they cracked a single wallet. It's that secure. So when a target actually follows best practices, offline device, seed phrase offline, the keyboard-based playbook collapses.
Which means the attacker's entire problem becomes physical. Either steal the phrase, coerce it out of you, or catch you in a moment when you've stored it badly. Photo in iCloud, note on your desk, screenshots in your camera roll. And that's where their victim selection starts to matter. So you've got these scammers with massive databases, the good-ass Yahoo's list. They knew exactly who held the money. But when they hit a target with excellent digital hygiene, all their tricks, phishing links, SIM swapping, became completely useless.
You literally cannot social engineer a piece of paper sitting in a fireproof lockbox. So the enterprise hit this fundamental limitation of cybercrime. But instead of moving on, they recognized a different vulnerability. The weakness wasn't the encryption, it was the human being holding the device.
It's the ultimate irony of cold storage. You build an impenetrable digital fortress, but you leave the person holding the keys entirely exposed in the physical world.
I've seen this used in extortion cases. You don't need to hack the bank vault if you can just follow the bank manager home and put a weapon to his head. In information security circles, there is a darkly comedic term for this, a wrench attack. The concept is simple. You don't need a multi-million dollar server farm. You just need a $5 wrench from a local hardware store and physical access to the person who knows the password. You strike them until they hand over the device and the seed phrase.
It's primitive, it's brutal, and it circumvents billions of dollars in global cybersecurity infrastructure in seconds. In plain English, if someone can't pick the lock, they stop trying to pick the lock, and they start threatening the person with the key. All the encryption in the world doesn't matter if the attacker can get you to unlock it for them. And that's what makes this so terrifying. It turns cybersecurity into personal security overnight.
That's right, Sue. This wasn't a one-off crime of passion. They formalized it. They created a dedicated role within their hierarchy specifically for, and I quote, residential burglars targeting hardware virtual currency wallets. That is not an exaggeration. It's literally a job description in the federal RICO conspiracy charges. And for listeners who hear RICO and think mob movie, here's the plain English version. RICO is the federal tool prosecutors use to charge the organization, not just the individual crimes. Instead of treating a burglary, a wire fraud, and an extortion as three separate cases, RICO lets the government show a pattern, repeated predicate crimes, tied to an enterprise with roles, rules, and continuity. It's how the feds connect the dots between the hackers, the money movers, and the on-the-ground muscle. I've seen that statute used up close in investigations I worked and cases I was associated with, because once you're dealing with a real network, a real hierarchy, and real coordination across state lines, RICO becomes the framework that captures the whole machine.
So in normal people terms, RICO is how the government says, we're not just chasing a bunch of separate crimes, we're taking down the crew running the whole operation. And when you look at how this group was set up, it really does look like a business. On one side, you've got the online con artists and thieves, people sitting behind screens, stealing access, moving money, and picking targets. On the other side, you've got the guys willing to show up in the real world, break into houses, threaten people, and do the dirty work. Different job titles, same team, all coordinated toward the same payday.
That's exactly right, Sue. And that crew framing is important, because RICO is how prosecutors stop a group like this from playing whack-a-mole. It prevents the leaders and organizers from hiding behind layers of cutouts while the youngest guy takes the fall. If the government can prove the team is working together over time, same mission, different roles, then everyone tied to that machine can be held accountable for the pattern, not just the one act they personally committed. And in this case, the documents show they didn't just have a loose group chat. They had structure. They had tasking. They had people who picked targets, people who watched, people who moved money, and people who kicked in doors. Which brings us to the operative who stepped up to fill the most dangerous role in that lineup, Marlon Farrow, operating under the aliases Marlo and Goth Ferrari.
Goth Ferrari. It sounds like a handle you would see in a Call of Duty lobby or a late-night Discord server.
Because that's exactly what it is. And it tracks with his demographic. He was only 19 years old, a teenager from Santa Ana, California. As an investigator, looking at the psychological profile here is baffling. How does a kid cross the line from talking trash on a headset in his bedroom to becoming a transnational physical home invader?
It speaks to digital desensitization. These kids grow up in digital environments where actions rarely carry physical consequences. In the digital realm, stealing millions looks like a ledger updating. There's no physical struggle. There's no blood. And on top of that, the whole thing is structured to feel like a game. You get a handle, you join a server, you rack up wins, you post receipts, you get applause. The victim isn't a person in front of you. They're an anonymous username on the other side of a screen. So the moral friction disappears. It becomes clicks, status, and dopamine. And when you live long enough in that world, it gets dangerously easy to convince yourself that what you're doing is just hustling. Until someone decides the next level up is a front door.
But physical burglary, kicking in a front door, the sensory overload is extreme. The adrenaline spike, the smell of the house, the noise of splintering wood, and the risk that the homeowner is standing there with a shotgun. Transitioning to that chaotic environment requires an immense level of sociopathy or extreme detachment. They are treating real life with the same stakes as a video game.
But in a video game, you respawn. In the real world, there's no reset button. There's a spouse getting a phone call, there are kids waking up to police lights, and there's trauma that doesn't log off when you close the laptop. Somebody ends up in a hospital or a morgue.
Exactly. And here's the next big question. How do you turn an online target into a real-world address? A hacked account can tell you a username, an email, maybe a city, but it doesn't tell you which house to hit, which door to walk up to, or when the person is gone. An IP address might narrow you down to an area, sometimes just a neighborhood, but it's not a street number. To pull off a home invasion, you need location and timing.
So how do they close that gap? Do they follow you in the real world? Pay someone locally to watch your house? Hire a private investigator? Because they'd need more than somewhere in Phoenix. They'd need your front door.
Exactly. And in most old school burglary crews, that's what it takes. But this enterprise took a shortcut. They didn't need to put eyes on the house first. They hacked the one thing most of us carry everywhere, our phones, by getting into the victim's cloud accounts, specifically Apple iCloud. Once you're in there, location stops being a guess and starts being a map.
Most people share their location with family through Apple's Find My network. You're saying the syndicate turned those phones into active homing beacons?
Precisely. If they breach your iCloud, they have your daily routine. They know when you drop the kids at school, when you're at work, and when you are furthest from your safe. The ringleader, 20-year-old Malone Lamb, alias King Greaves, exploited the Apple Mesh network. Every Apple device is constantly communicating via low-energy Bluetooth. It creates a web of location data accurate down to a few feet.
So Malone Lamb was sitting in a luxury rental mansion in Miami, exploiting that mesh network to gain complete real-time access to victims' location data.
Yes, and the key is what that access lets you do. It's not just, I know where you are. It's, I know when you're far enough away for long enough to hit your house. It lets them confirm patterns, work, gym, school drop-off, and then pick the exact window when the risk is lowest. And it gives them instant correction. If the victim's location suddenly turns around, they can call off the operation. If the victim stops unexpectedly, they can delay. In other words, they're not guessing anymore. They're running the burglary off a dashboard.
So the victim is basically being used like a remote control. Their own phone is telling the criminals, now's the moment, they're not home, go. And the creepiest part is, the victim could be living totally normally, running errands, picking up groceries, while someone 1,000 miles away is making decisions about their safety.
The tactical advantage is massive. In a traditional burglary ring, casing a house takes weeks of physical presence. Driving through the neighborhood, watching the house, risking being spotted by a neighbor or a ring camera. You're guessing. You're building a pattern from a handful of sightings, and every minute you're parked on that street, you're creating a witness. But with this kind of real-time location access, the criminals don't case the house. They monitor the person. And that's the difference between a burglary and an operation. Here's what makes it so powerful in plain terms. In most cities, there are Apple devices everywhere. Cars next to you at a light, phones in a grocery store, laptops in an office. When a victim's phone is leaking its location through the Find My ecosystem, it can get seen again and again throughout the day, creating a steady stream of updates without anyone noticing. That density turns a one-time hack into persistent tracking. When I was running surveillances during my law enforcement career, it took a team of 6 agents and days of excruciating boredom to establish a basic routine, and we still had blind spots. But Lamb achieved frictionless omnipresence from thousands of miles away. He didn't need a stakeout car. He had the victim's life on a map.
It's a profound violation of privacy. The device you carry to feel safe is actively broadcasting your coordinates to a teenage crime boss. They know when you drop your kids off. They know when you are sitting at your office desk 30 miles away.
And this wasn't theoretical. In the summer of 2024, Lamb and Farrow put this digital stalking blueprint into motion in New Mexico. The enterprise identified a specific target, referred to in court documents as Victim 4. They confirmed the victim held hundreds of thousands in crypto on hardware wallets.
So the money was locked up tight, the online tricks weren't working, and the call went out to take it in person. In street terms, when they can't get you through the screen, they try to pull up to your life. No more DMs, no more phishing. Now it's boots on the ground. That's the escalation we keep talking about.
Right, Marlon Farrow, Goth Ferrari, is activated. He physically travels from California to New Mexico. Consider the logistics for a 19-year-old. Booking flights, securing ground transport in an unfamiliar city, and assuming the federal risk of crossing state lines to commit a felony. The moment he steps onto that plane, the digital abstraction vanishes. It gets real. Very quick.
And once Pharaoh is on the ground, he deploys a very calculated surveillance setup. He didn't just drive past the house, did he?
No. Instead, he set up a stationary drop camera. He placed a telephone equipped with a video camera directly across the street from the victim's residence. He had to hide it in the branches of a tree or a storm drain, ensuring a clear line of sight to the front door.
And the most chilling detail? He set that phone to actively live stream the property back to the rest of the enterprise.
Exactly. So Malone Lamb and the rest of the syndicate, wherever they were, had a high-definition, real-time video feed of the target's perimeter. Back in the day, law enforcement needed federal warrants and bucket trucks to do that. Pharaoh did it with a piece of consumer electronics taped to a tree.
Which leads us to July 8th, 2024, the day the plan moved from stalking to action. According to the allegations, this is when the enterprise synchronized all three pieces at once: the hacked iCloud account to track the victim's movements, the hidden drop camera streaming the front of the house, and Pharaoh on the ground ready to move the moment the window opened. This is the part of the case that feels less like a random burglary and more like a coordinated hit. Remote eyes watching, a live feed confirming the perimeter, and a go, no-go decision based on that blinking blue dot. One mistake, one unexpected U-turn, and it all collapses. But on that day, the paperwork suggests they believed they had the timing nailed.
Picture the screens in that Miami mansion. On one side, the live stream from the drop camera aimed at the victim's front door. On the other, the victim's compromised iCloud account tracking their phone in real time. And then a third line open, messages to Pharaoh, because the second the victim's dot drifts far enough away, the call goes out. Go. That's not a burglary crew freelancing. That's an operation being run from a command post. It's a flawless execution of an overwatch tactic. In military terms, an overwatch element provides protective intelligence to the team on the objective.
So Lamb and the remote members were an infallible early warning system.
Precisely. If the blinking blue dot on the iCloud map suddenly changed direction and headed back to the neighborhood, Lamb would see it. If a neighbor walked their dog past the broken door, Lamb would see it. He could instantly alert Pharaoh via signal or telegram. Abort. The target is 2 miles out. Get out now. It is military-grade coordination applied to a residential burglary by teenagers.
But Nick, if they're leaning on phones and live feeds like that, what happens when the tech hiccups? What if the dot on the map is wrong for a minute? What if the phone dies? What if the stream freezes or the camera gets bumped? Because if their whole plan is built on the house is clear, one bad update turns this from a coordinated operation into chaos.
Always. And Sue, that's exactly the kind of question investigators obsess over. Because in the real world, real time is almost never real time. There's latency. There's dead zones, there's battery loss, and there's human error layered on top of all of it. What if the victim's phone dies while they're at lunch? Suddenly, Lamb is blind. The victim heads home unexpectedly. Or what if the cellular network lags by 60 seconds? Lamb tells Pharaoh the driveway is clear, but the victim is already parked and is putting their key in the front door. And speaking from my law enforcement background, when you run surveillance, you plan around one brutal truth. Seconds matter, and bad information is worse than no information. A 1 minute delay can put two people in the same place at the same time, and now you've got a startled 19-year-old criminal face to face with a homeowner. That's why good teams build in confirmation, multiple sources, eyes on the target, somebody calling the play who understands the reaction time problem. These kids are trying to do the same thing with hacked phones and a drop camera, but they're doing it without training, without restraint, and without a safety net, it's a recipe for a fatal confrontation.
And yet, despite those risks, the New Mexico operation was executed. Farrow breached the home, searched for the wallets, and managed to extract himself.
The fact that he managed to do this without being apprehended on site proves that the barrier between cybercrime and violent crime has officially collapsed. The enterprise has proven that digital exposure guarantees physical exposure.
We have to completely synthesize what this means. For decades, we've viewed cybercriminals as ghosts in the machine. People who could drain a bank account but couldn't physically touch us. It used to feel like the worst case scenario was a wiped out savings account and a nightmare with customer support. You change passwords, you cancel cards, you file a report, and you try to move on. But this case shows the line has moved. The same crew that's texting you links and talking you into giving up access can also show up at your house when the money is out of reach online. And that means the threat isn't just identity theft. It's your front door, your family, and the places you thought were private.
You nailed it, Sue. That ghosts in the machine era is over. And this is where OPSEC matters. Operational security isn't some special forces thing. It's just the common sense steps you take so strangers can't piece together your life like a puzzle. It's keeping your real-world routine, location, and access points from being easy to map. In this case, weak OPSEC can be as simple as sharing your location too widely, leaving your cloud account easy to hijack, reusing passwords or saving sensitive stuff like wallet recovery words, photos of IDs, or notes to self where it can be pulled remotely. Once a crew has that, they don't just know who you are. They know where you are, when you're away, and what you're worth. So yeah, the illusion is gone. If you have money and your digital OPSEC is sloppy, you're not just risking fraud. You're potentially putting a target on your front door.
It changes how law enforcement has to approach these networks, doesn't it?
Completely. Your physical safety now relies entirely on your digital hygiene. Locking your deadbolts isn't enough if a hacker owns your Google location history. We cannot treat these networks like white-collar wire fraudsters anymore. Law enforcement is facing an entirely new breed of criminal: violent, transnational, organized crime syndicates.
It's a chilling reality. What's next?
Imagine 5 years from now, when augmented reality and AI enter the hands of organized crime. What happens when a crew can use AI to imitate your bank's voice on the phone and keep you calm while another member is already on the way to your house? What happens when they can scrape your social media and build a detailed picture of your routine, the school logo on your kid's hoodie, the gym you go to, the landmarks outside your office? What happens when they don't need to find you at all because your smart home, your car, and your location sharing are all quietly telling on you? And yes, what happens when autonomous drones provide overwatch from 2,000 feet, tracking a target in real time? That's the trajectory if we keep treating this like a password problem instead of a personal safety problem.
Wow, Nick, we covered a lot today. We went from seed phrases and cold storage to real-world surveillance, command post coordination, and a crew that was willing to travel across state lines to take it in person. If you're listening and you feel unsettled, good. That means you're paying attention. Thanks for sticking with us on this deep dive.
We did, and Sue's right, we covered a lot. But we still haven't covered everything in this fascinating and very real case. Next in part 3, the final reckoning. We're going to walk through how this enterprise starts to unravel, how investigators begin tying online handles to real people, how the timeline tightens around key players, and what small mistakes turn into big breaks. We'll talk about the kinds of evidence that matter in cases like this: devices, accounts, travel, communications, and how federal investigators build a story a jury can understand.
We'll also follow the money, how stolen crypto gets converted, where it goes, what it buys, and how that lifestyle becomes a lead. And we'll bring it into the courtroom, arrests, plea deals, sentencing exposure, and what RICO means when prosecutors decide they're not charging a crime, they're charging the enterprise. Most importantly, we'll end with practical lessons from this case: what to lock down, what to stop oversharing, and how to reduce your real-world risk in a world where online and offline are no longer separate. This has been a production of the SOS Media Network and Scam TV. Stay vigilant and stay safe.